I'm really an amateur on the problem before us tonight, but I have become interested in it. I think the problem is expressed well in a little cartoon I saw once. The first scene, there are two psychiatrists walking into the elevator in the morning in a large medical dental building, both looking fresh and well. And they go up to, I don't know, 22nd floor. They both had an office on the 22nd floor. And then the next scene shows them at the end of the day coming down the elevator. And the old man is still looking fresh. The young man, very bedraggled, very tired. He looks at the old man and he says, how can you look so fresh? How can you listen to all this that we have to listen to every day and look so fresh? And the old man said, who listens? That's my problem at home. That's the problem that my children say they have. Nobody listens to them. My wife often says that. I can see that. I think she laughed. Or when I tell them something, they don't do what I tell them, but something else. And it's become very acute lately because I've been in industry for quite a while, and although I had some nominal teaching, I have more responsibilities in the teaching now, and I have, I think, quality students, and I am disturbed by sometimes what they give me back of what I give them. I prepare some sterling lectures. They're given at least in a loud voice, and so they all hear it, I hope. But somehow it doesn't always hang in, you know? And this has been very disturbing to me. And so I've done a bit of investigation into it, and trying to find out, well, what work has been done in this field. I realized, of course, that God has had the same trouble. Jesus had the same trouble. The prophets, you know, you have ears and you do not hear. Huh? How many times do you think that's in the Bible? I mean, it's all through it. There are over about 1,200 references. I quit counting after 1,200 to hearing, listening, and so forth. So they had a problem too. So I was pleased that others, I wasn't alone in this difficulty. I think it's expressed very well by John Godfrey. Now, I'm going to tell you what he said. Now, old John Godfrey was about 80 years old. He had retired. And there were a lot of people, hardly anyone really knew very much about John Godfrey. He was an immigrant, or his parents were immigrants at least. And he wanted to really be a poet, but his folks, as immigrants, thought he should be something else. They thought he should be a lawyer. So he became a lawyer. He took a little electronics on the side. A lot of people didn't realize this. He was sort of an average type lawyer. When he got to be about 80 years old, he turned over the 4 acres that he had kept in the middle of this city against all the encroachment of the large city around him. And he called in some first-rate architects, and he designed with them a building that had 2 rooms. It was a very well-constructed, very beautifully constructed, and lovely gardens around it. And then the day came sort of for open house. Of course, there was a lot of talk about what was going on there. Over the door in gold lettering was "The Man Who Listens," in memory of Stella Godfrey, which was his wife. She'd been dead a long time. And in the outside, in the entrance room, quite large, there was another slot in the door, sort of, said, "For requests to be heard." And it said at the side of the alcove, "If you wish to see a man who listened to you, touch the button above and you will see his face, and he will be glad if you thank him, but it isn't necessary." And it was also said that voices of the desperate operate some kind of an electrical impulse that opened the curtain after they had finished their confidences and had touched the button. But those who came with false confidences out of curiosity found that even when they touched the button, the curtain would not open. Now, in the interview, when all the newsmen were around, they said, "What do you expect people to say in here?" asked one reporter. And "They will know before they come," said John. "One of the most terrible aspects of this world today is that nobody listens to anyone else. If you are sick or even dying, nobody listens. If you are bewildered or frightened or lost or bereaved or alone or lonely, nobody really listens. Even the clergy are hurried and harassed. They do their best and work endlessly. But time has taken on a fragmented character. It doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anyone, not even those who love you and would die for you. Your parents, your children, your friends, they have no time. That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? Whose fault is it? I don't know. But there doesn't seem to be any time." Now, John Godfrey is a figment of Taylor Caldwell's imagination in The Listener. Now, in part of my investigation, it took me to the work of Dr. Nichols at the University of Minnesota. Now, I have not heard Nichols except on tapes, and some of you have heard him, so some of the material I will be presenting to you will probably be old hat. I will infuse in it a few of my own experiences, and then I will depart from this to take on a sort of a new dimension on this at the close. Now, there was a fellow named Hubble, I think at Columbia, I forgot now where, but he said about 98% of all that we learn through our eyes and ears. And a fellow named Parker at Ohio State, who is a communication expert, he decided to log the activity of people, and he took white collar workers. When I was in General Electric Company, we also did this. We took time studies and what we spent our time at, you know. Well, he took quite a sampling, I think in excess of 60 people, and about every 15 minutes they were started to log in what they did. And they did this over a period of several months. Now, it would be different, of course, for different groups. But this particular sampling spent 70% of their time in communication, 9% of it in writing, 16% in reading, 30% in speaking, and 45% in listening. Now, I know quite a few people that would be a lot higher for the speaking part, but this happened to be this group. Now, when you then analyze the curriculum in school, there are many of you who have spent 16 years, and a great part of it was in writing and reading, at least 8 years concentrated in reading. And fortunately, in later times, we have some speaking. I mean, some training in speaking. But in my time, I didn't take a course in speaking, and it probably showed. I didn't take a course in speaking until I was a senior in college, and because it happened to be a requirement to get out. well, of course, we had some plays in high school, and I had some bit parts in some plays. But we had sometimes you'd have a debating team for preachers and lawyers' sons. But that was about it, you see. Now, Dr. Nichols from the University of Minnesota, as you well know, he's an engineer, I think, and he became very interested in this, not only from the standpoint of manufacturing. And industry, of course, has been interested in this a long time. And perhaps I should tell you about industry's experience first. And Dr. Nichols found this, certainly. He related one incident where this student came to a professor, I think, down in New Orleans, and he said he wanted to do a PhD study in communication. He said, "Well, we'll have you do it on listening." And this was, of course, unheard of almost at the time. He says, "What I want you to do is to put on your good clothes and try to get into all the executives in town here for the next 4 or 5 days and get their views on their company and their employees and so forth." So he took his notebook, he got in to see a lot of them, and he made notes on it, and sort of to a man. I can hear him now, because I was in the lower managerial ranks of a business. Although I was a little closer to him, because I was there's a lot of layers in the company. I imagine there was five or six, at least, between me and Cordner in the General Electric Company, and that's a long way. If I had been one step lower, I would have probably been in the sheep pen looking out. But I was still classified as management. But I had a big ear, and I was close to the ground, sir. But we have this difficulty. Well, I can hear these managers now saying, we have a great company. Our communications are probably the best. We've done all of this. We have a psychologist working. We have a suggestion plan. And we run tests. We have surveys, employee attitude surveys. And things are great. Well, how do the employees, how's your relations with them? Well, we have the most loyal employees of any company, So then he came back with this, and he told his professor what he learned, He said, all right, now, this is what you're going to do for the next year. You're going to be an assistant truck driver, and you're going to try to work in these various plants. And then you're going to keep a notebook, and you're going to write down what the employees say, And after a year, this many notebooks, and there were weeks going through this data. And to make a long story short, the employees generally, they hated their guts, what a lousy outfit this was. They didn't know what was going on. They didn't appreciate what they were doing. And they never knew what the boss wanted. And this is sort of how it stood. Well, of course, the General Electric Company itself has been very concerned about this. And they've tried various things. And they've made communication centers so that when sort of the chairman of the board speaks, he can sort of speak to the communication center who can get it right to the employee. If you do surveys, you'll find out that there's a lot lost from the chairman of the board to the acting vice president, because he's pretty nervous in there, And when you're kind of all shook up, you don't always make very good notes, or you don't recall well, or you don't hear well, There's pretty good communication from a vice president to a vice president, as long as they're not competing too much. Or a foreman to a foreman, This is pretty good. But when you go these steps, there are difficulties. Now, there's a lot of companies tried various tricks. One of the companies says, let's get a very attractive nurse, sort of a matronly type, very attractive, and we'll set her up as sort of a communication center to be a listener. Oh boy, She set up office, people lined up outside waiting to see her, This was really great. It was good for 2 days. And then some rat fink said that she was a stool pigeon for the vice president or something, No more lines. A competing company said, they don't know what they're doing. People aren't used to crying on the mother's shoulder. You need a father figure. So they got a retired chaplain. This sounded great. He was a great guy. He had a lot of experience in this. They set him up. The lines formed. It worked for 4 days. And then some rat fink said that he was a stool pigeon or a listening post for the general manager. And they immediately become suspicious. We've had psychologists. There's been a lot of attempts at this, and I think some progress is being made. We have attitude surveys. I remember we had the first attitude surveys. General Electric wanted to find out just what is the attitude of these people. And I know in our particular component, tell them just the way you feel, Well, I just put it down there. Boy, they did, And we paid for it, because our particular component, the general manager, I think he was by there every week we got tired of it, He's down there wondering, boy, what's something wrong with this outfit, And the truth was, they probably told the truth, We stretch it now and then. But boy, then catches on the next one, Things were great then. Then improved, but they were great, I think they had improved somewhat. Now, in the scholastic, in the school situation now, and this is one, of course, that Nichols has been interested in, and other people. It started earlier, a fellow named Harvey Jones at Columbia. And this is always a shock to a professor to get these incoming freshmen. He had 460 or something, and he lectured to them in psychology. And then he gave them a test. And they sort of got average out maybe 50% of what he told them. This was very disturbing to him. He thought, well, it's something wrong with him, maybe. So what he did was he lined up some of the a series of professors and says, now I want you to give a 10-minute lecture to these students on your favorite subject. I mean, and do it well. So they were really primed for bear. You know, they came in there loaded. They give them the whole load of hay in 10 minutes. And then he had their lecture ahead of time, so he made what he thought was a fair test. And he essentially found the same thing. That they got about 50% of what they gave them. And then he gave the same test to them in 2 months. And then they were down to 25%. And this was indeed disturbing to him. It was disturbing to Nichols, who told me about, who you've heard. And so he tried it at the University of Minnesota. Only he tested them within about 2 weeks. And they retained about 25% of what he told them. He thinks, too, that probably he'd get about the same result if he gave the test again in 2 days. Now, of course, this causes a lot of difficulties. I mean, we don't learn as much probably as we should. And, of course, in industry, it causes accidents because we don't always pay attention. We don't hear. We don't speak well. It makes for a lot of disturbances and ill will, even probably at Holden, you know. You don't hear quite what they tell you. The pots should have been washed, and they weren't, you know, something like that. And so people get angry. Now, Nichols, about 10 or 15 years ago, probably in the early 50s, he made a survey. He looked at the scientific literature, and he says, well, how much in the scientific literature is there being reported, say, on speaking and reading compared with listening? He could only find one legitimate paper on listening that was of any scientific quality. There were 3,000 on speaking or writing. And he thought this was something wrong here. Have they been teaching it? So maybe this is a teachable subject. He found one school that taught listening. That was Stevens College down Missouri. Isn't it St. Charles or somewhere? Sort of one of the social graces. The girls had to learn how to listen. They probably make interesting wives. But now I'm happy to report that many more are now teaching. Probably you're going to teach it. And I talked to, where's Joanne? Did Joanne make it or is she down the lift?
No, I'm here.
Great. I'm glad you made it, even if you're not. All right. She's interested. She had something on it last summer. Now what Nichols then did, he said, boy, we gotta research this thing. So he sort of assembled a bunch of students and he separated them out to as this group is the worst listeners because, boy, they don't hear for nothing. And these fellows seem to be listening well. So he gave them a whole battery of tests, various psychological tests, which I hope Paul Hain isn't there because he's opposed to these. It's an encroachment on your freedom. A reading, a comprehension test, and so forth, you see? And then he analyzed this, and he found out sort of 10 things that characterize the good and bad listeners. And this is to help you students now next year how to beat the professor, you know. Now, the first thing he found was that the bad listener says, this is an uninteresting subject. What a lousy subject, you know. I mean, some of you probably tonight. I mean, there's nothing else going, so we listen to the something on listening, you know. Because there's nothing else, huh? So you're sitting up there. And why can't they talk about something else, you know? And see, your mind wanders, and you're no longer with us. And this is the characteristic of the bad listener. Where the good listener was selfish about it in a way. He says, now, he might start from the same place. He's listening. Oh boy, what are they going to think of next? You know, but it's a kind of a challenge. Maybe he'll tell me something I might be able to use. You know, and that's where they started. And as a result of it, they might have got something out of it. And he quoted Chesterton at this point, and I'm going to quote him Wednesday night too. I'm very fond of Chesterton now because he's very fond of pigs. I found him. But, he thinks they're beautiful. But he says there's no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, only uninteresting people. So there. All right, now, number 2 point was that the bad listener always started out criticizing the speaker. You know? I mean, look at that guy. Boy, I'd like to, look at those ears, huh? I'd like to have that nose full of nickels, you know? Or, hey, he's sitting there without his shoes on. Boy, or he's wearing a turtleneck sweater. He's worn that turtleneck sweater every day since he's got here. They were popular 10 years ago. And they go on from here, you know. And he doesn't speak really good English. I've already noted 5 errors in English since he started. But at this point, Nichols would probably say, if somebody came in here now and said, you jokers better bug out of this shack because it's on fire, huh? You wouldn't stop and say, couch that in better rhetoric, you know. So, so you see, I mean, so you kind of overlook the dirty green pants, the sweater, and his old orange shirt, and second day I wore these green socks. All the others were dirty. My wife washed today, and I don't like to go barefooted. So you listen to what he says. Maybe he's going to say something worthwhile. Now, the other thing, and I've noticed this in the class, because I teach in a professional course, and I don't teach for quite a while, but I try to make all the lectures when I'm in town, and I kind of watch the students from the back of the room. It's quite a large class, probably 90 students in there, and that's a big class in a professional school. And I kind of listen for them, see what they say, you know. And they're out in the hallway, and of course I have a couple of listening posts in the class. I mean, I have a couple of graduate students, you know, and they got to get through, you know. So they feed the information to you, and I usually hire somebody on, say, on a work study, you know. He likes to get along with me, so he and I have pretty good rapport with him. So he tells me what the fellows think of it. So I have a pretty good case on what they're saying about me and everybody else, you know. And it's always enlightening. But after you've raised teenagers, you can stand anything. So I think everybody, when he begins teaching, he should have a teenager or been raised with him. But they get all worked up, you know. And they, what a lousy course and what a lousy lecture. And they go on sort of from what I said before, you know. They judge the thing before they're really clear through it. And here I should point out that it's well to withhold your evaluation of a course a lot of times. Of course, some of them, I mean, you can tell they're lousy in the first 10 minutes and they don't improve during the semester. This is true. Because when I came to the University of California, I made a point to go and listen to some of the lectures outside, you know. I hear this guy's a great lecturer, so I go and listen to him and I'll listen to some others. Boy, there was some lousy lecture, you know. In fact, I think we can do better things than just lecturing every day to students. But I'm not dictator yet, but I'm going to change it. But and we are modifying some of the approaches, but it takes a long time. Boy, it takes a long time. You know, I worked at a General Electric company and we had a government contract, you know. And I thought we had a lot of red tape, certainly a lot more than industry. But boy, there's nothing like the university. The government red tape is nothing compared with the University of California. And you can tell them I said so. So hear them before you judge them, you know, and hear them out. And I know a lot of people, boy, they really got mad at that professor. And he really was a sort of a bum guy. But after the course was over, I mean, maybe they really thought this was really worthwhile. Where another one is a real silver-tongued orator, and he may make it sound so smooth, you know, and so easy, when it really isn't, see? So withhold your judgment. The other poor listeners, number 4, they had a great respect for facts, you know. They wrote down all the dates and, you know, these facts, so they could cite them off. They probably remember them for 1 day or 2, half of them they would. But rather than to try to give the sense of the discourse, you see, what are the points and ideas he's really trying to get at? Try to get the central core. Number five, and I watch them do this too. They try to make an outline. Boy, 1 inch over here, you know, 2 inches over here, and make a real neat outline. And they spend so much time at this, you know. And then you go back to it when you study for the final or the midterm, you know. You can't even figure it out. Although the margins are straight. This was true with a bum listener. I remember when I was in graduate school with the medical students, they came to course with me. And there was one, he was from Harvard. He took his pre-med at Harvard. And boy, he took the neatest notes you ever saw. Boy, they were really neat. But he spent too much time at it. And he didn't often get the point of the story. So again, concentrate on the sense of the thing and it's best to wait sort of a little while because you may not know it, but all the professors, they don't always work from an outline, you know? The way I do it, I make out a rather detailed outline for the students where if they got the outline and went home, you know, and stayed there, they'd still pass the test if they knew these facts, although they facts and theories and sort of philosophy the thing, but they'd miss quite a bit. But the other thing I do, I give them all the charts that I'm going to use because I don't feel the students should be stenographers, you know. And all the charts that I'm going to drop there, I've always been, and I've gone to school about as long as anybody, and boy, those props, you know, they go up and draw an X, Y axis, they draw the chart and put up a whole bunch of stuff, or in math, differential equations, you know. By the time you're well through it, you know, well, you got that, you know, they race it off and start, you know, and you sit there and you're so mad at them, you know, you can't get more. So I always give them all these charts, and then I refer to them on one of these projectors we have over here, you know. And this seems to work well, because and I leave some space so they can sort of use their own ingenuity in establishing the evidence. And this is what's important. I mean, you have a certain philosophy or belief or a theory or an idea, and then you shore it up with evidence. And this is what they must establish. And also it helps in their reading. And this is very important for you who are still students. I mean, admittedly, there's a lot of lectures. You're better off either staying in bed, but more importantly, reading. Huh? I mean, and I think this is one thing you learn here at Holden. A lot of people, they leave here and they start reading books when they never read them before, you know. There's so many good books written, a lot of lousy ones too, but in the sciences at least, I mean, read the book. And this is a lot of times is better than going to some lectures. But if you have to, you should do both. But if you have to skip one, it's better that you read probably. And then have a session with the professor. But I think we're going to get to a point where maybe you'll have some lectures, but then have small discussion groups and testing. Because it's very useful to me that I get them in lab, and then I circulate around, and then you sort of face-to-face, you know. You find out whether, in a short time, whether they're cutting the mustard, you know, or whether they heard you. Or also whether I get across the point. Because this is another useful thing I found out for some of you who are professors. Maybe you already use this trick, but I use a work study boy or somebody, in fact he's doing it right now in the last course. He gets the